Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Covering a presidential primary is always a hefty undertaking for media outlets, but our guest today says this year it's an enormous challenge. Not only are there an unprecedented number of candidates, but news organizations are operating in an unprecedented environment where the label fake news lowers public trust and where many people choose to bypass traditional journalism in favor of their social media feeds. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with Domenico Montanaro. He's NPR's senior political editor and correspondent. Domenico joined us last night at NHPR's Justice and Journalism event, a partnership with the Rudman Center at UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law. This hour, we'll look at how NPR and other media are covering the primary, and we'd like to hear from you. So, listeners, how are you following this primary? What news coverage feels valuable to you, and what makes you tune out? Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. And Domenico, welcome. Nice to see you. Thank you for coming to New Hampshire.
Well, thank you for having me.
So before we get into how NPR and the news business in general are covering this primary, I just love your big thoughts, Domenico, please, on what we're seeing right now. What stands out to you about this primary compared to primaries past?
Well, there's just so many candidates, and you have to figure out when you're covering these things how to, you know, just put your resources out there and get coverage of all of these candidates and figure out which issues are most important to them, how they'll filter themselves out. I mean, I do think that you're seeing a bit of a sorting that's going on, and, you know, it really has emerged where Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, and to a lesser extent Bernie Sanders and the rest of the field are competing for the nomination. And that's really starting to become pretty evident with about 5 months to go before voting begins.
What drives that sorting, Domenico?
Well, I think right now in this primary, so many of these Democratic voters are saying that they want to beat President Trump.
That's their first priority.
That's their first priority, their top priority. We ask these questions on whether you want somebody who can beat Trump versus someone who agrees with you on the issues. And a lot of Democrats are making the judgment that they'd rather have somebody who can beat Trump. But how they define that is very different. And what we're seeing is some of these candidates or some of these voters are looking at Joe Biden as the most electable candidate. Others are saying that their heart is with Elizabeth Warren, and they're starting to see her as someone who's more electable, too, because of how she makes her message and how she has such a strong core.
Well, and a little bit later, we'll talk a lot about the debates and how they play a role in this sorting process that you talk about, Domenico. But just broadly, again, as someone who's covered national politics for a long time, not just with NPR, but major news outlets like CBS and ABC and PBS, what's been surprising to you in terms of either the issues these candidates are talking about or how they talk about them? Any sort of, gee, I've never seen that before.
Well, I think that the urgency that a lot of Democratic voters feel toward winning in next year in 2020, and at the same time, their skittishness at feeling like they can't win. When we've polled and seen and looked at that, Republicans are far more confident that President Trump is going to win in 2020 than Democrats are. Democrats, for the most part, are not that satisfied with the field. They feel like if they could take a bunch of different parts of their candidates and meld them into one candidate, then maybe they'd have a great candidate. But it seems that none of these candidates have allayed the concerns and fears of Democratic voters that they're going to actually beat President Trump next year. And there's probably good reason for that. I mean, economic outlooks have still been pretty high, even though there have been some warnings about a potential recession. There isn't the kind of hot war going on where you see lists of young men and women who are dying every day. You know, it's not quite a 2008 scenario. I mean, think about what was going on then where Barack Obama was able to win. Well, the economy was in free fall. The Iraq war was still a disaster. And that made it so that it was much more difficult for John McCain to be able to try to win in 2008. But and remember, George W. Bush won re-election in 2004. So we're not talking about kind of a third term for a president who's leaving office. We're talking about a re-election. And in this country, re-elections are usually the strength is with the incumbent.
Wow. So on the Democratic side, urgency and skittishness. That sounds like a recipe for high anxiety.
High anxiety. I would say so.
Wow. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. We're talking about how the media is covering the primary, specifically NPR, because Domenico Montanaro is with us, senior political editor and correspondent at the network. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Domenico, Michael sent us an email. According to Pew, 21% of Americans have a lot of trust in the media. Roughly the same number of Americans who think Congress is doing a good job. Where does the majority of the blame lie for a lack of trust? Is it attacks by the president or missteps by the press? I know this is something that you've been talking about, Domenico, that not only is there an unprecedented number of candidates this year, but news organizations are operating in this unprecedented environment.
Well, you know, trust in the media has been something that's low for a long time. And it's obviously sad for me because I'm such an idealist about our profession. I really think that we have a critical role to play in a democracy and holding power accountable. I think that there are some outlets that have not done a great job, and you have to look at yourself first and think about, you know, what kind of coverage you're putting forward, what kinds of ideas you're putting into the public discourse, whether or not you're holding everybody accountable in lots of ways, whether your reporting is solid and airtight, and that you're being fair to everyone. I think that it's difficult because you have the president and other politicians who have for a long time, by the way, this president's not the first person to attack the media because it's the filter. And a lot of people in power don't want the filter to be there to stop their message from going forward. They'd rather be able to get that out unvarnished. And you're going to always have this sort of tension between people in power and the news media because we're the nosy people. You know, who likes the nosy people? The people who
you're doing that wrong.
We ask the impolitic questions.
Yeah.
We're the ones who ask about politics and religion and all the things you're not supposed to talk about at your Thanksgiving table. So sometimes we're impolite about the kinds of topic areas that make people uncomfortable. But in a democracy, that's an important thing to be able to pick at what is good and what's not great and what's working and what's not working as well in a democracy. And that is what sets us apart from so many of these other countries where, you know, you could have a government shut down our conversation right now because they didn't agree with the way we were talking about whomever was in power.
So blaming the messenger is not new. Michael, our listener, seems to be wondering whether the heightened attacks now are creating a lack of trust in media and people maybe just tuning out of our presidential primary coverage.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is, because of the fracturing of the way people get their news information through social media, through links where they feel that their worldview can be reaffirmed and affirmed, that's been a real problem. It's very difficult to break through with a mass audience of people to say that the information that we're putting forward is real, it's trustworthy, the sourcing is unimpeachable, and that, you know, NPR's reporting is the same as something on the fringe. I think that that is potentially problematic because when you look at it all online, it just looks flat. It doesn't, there's nowhere to say this is more important than something else, and people have to be more discerning with their choice of coverage.
When I asked you earlier, Domenico, what was surprising about this primary in particular, you said urgency and skittishness at the same time on the part of Democrats. What about the issues, Domenico? Are there issues in this Democratic primary field that have really come to the fore that perhaps has surprised you?
Well, not surprisingly, healthcare has been the main issue of the Democratic primary. And I think that that's critical because so many Democrats have thought very strongly about healthcare, how to reshape the system, how to work on either building on the Affordable Care Act or going a completely different way and trying to institute more quickly something like Medicare for All, which has become controversial. Our polling has found that Medicare for All, as a replacement to private insurance, is pretty unpopular with the broader public. But Medicare for All as an option in addition to private health insurance, or you could say I would like that as opposed to, then that's very popular, actually, quite broadly. And I think that's part of why you've seen a kind of adjustment of the discussion on this. There wasn't that much in the way of polling before this last debate. And then a lot of us had gone out there sort of polling on it, wondering what was what did people think about that? And that's why you hear people like Mayor Pete Buttigieg of Indiana, Joe Biden, saying things like, you know, we're for Medicare for all who want it, as opposed to Medicare for all as a replacement, like Bernie Sanders argues for, and that Elizabeth Warren at least says that she agrees with. She's not quite out there as strongly on this as Bernie Sanders is. She's perfectly happy to let him make the argument for that.
So not surprising that health care is an issue. It's been an issue for a long time, especially among Democratic primary voters. But interesting, anyway, Domenico, to you, how this has sort of evolved as we, the public and political reporters, understand how voters feel about this.
And I think that Democrats were able to use health care as something to win in 2018, as a vehicle anyway. But remember, one of the principal factors in people's votes in 2018 was President Trump. I mean, we still see in polling that 45% of people, for example, our latest NPR PBS NewsHour Marist polling found that people strongly disapprove of the president. 45%. That's the highest number in this presidency. It's a record high. He has a very strong opposition. People will go to the polls. About 45% of the country is about the floor for any Democratic candidate and about the floor for any Republican candidate. There's an intensity there on both sides, and that really stems from this crack up in culture, American culture, and what it means to be an American, what it means for who it means to be an American, who can come to this country, who can stay in this country. This has been radically reshifted since the 2015-2016 election because of the way President Trump was able to sort of stir up this kind of grievance with this nativism that he's put out there and pitted people against each other that now Democrats are trying to combat.
And this is something happening in other countries. There's a report on NPR this morning about similar cultural crack-ups in Germany, Domenico.
And there's something that President Trump was able to do in a different way, which was appeal to working-class voters. The way Democrats used to appeal to working-class voters, these lunch-pail Democrats as they were, was on economics. And they could say, you know, whether it was union voters, that the Democratic Party was in favor of the kinds of things and issues that these voters should be in favor of. And Trump did it from a different perspective. He did it on culture. So he did it with a right-wing populism. If someone like Elizabeth Warren is the nominee, you're going to see a left-wing populism, and you're going to see these two different kinds of populisms face off with each other. You know, Warren likes to talk about how, you know, that she goes to red states and she hears people nod or sees people nod when she talks about how the government is working. It's working just fine if you are wealthy and you want $1.5 trillion tax cut, you got it, but it's not working well for everyone else. She makes that populist message while President Trump makes a different kind of one.
Well, I have another question for you, Domenico, about that cultural crack up. But let's go to our listeners as well. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. And Domenico, let's go first to Amherst. Bill is on the line. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A few minutes ago, Domenico, you were talking about reporters making kind of in-politic questions to people. I kind of like to turn it around to you and ask you something that might be a little challenging to answer, which is I follow Fox News. I read and look at them just about every day just to see what they're saying. And both in terms of factual basis and omission, I just don't think it's a credible news source. And I know a lot of people like Fox, a lot of people watch Fox, but I think they're misleading people. I think they're misinformation. I don't want to use that term fake news, which I just did, but I just, you know, this may be hard for you to answer, but I wonder if you know, you work with colleagues from Fox. You're sometimes maybe even in NPR would source things from Fox when they're the only one covering it. But do you consider them, from your opinion, a credible news source?
Bill, thanks a lot for the call.
You know, I know some people who work for Fox News who are good reporters and do a good job. I know that there are some reporters, especially on the day side aspect of Fox, it's a little different than the prime time. But, you know, overall, Fox has been one of the reasons why the Republican Party has been able to get out the message that it has about the kind of difference of culture that they see in the country that Republicans have been able to use. And certainly they have skewed the news in a way that is far more right-leaning than a mainstream news outlet would be. I mean, all you have to do is look at the chyrons and the lower thirds that they put on their screen, the kinds of story selection and story choice that they make. It's hard to suggest that they are on overall, you know, a mainstream news outlet. They're not. I mean, it's a right leaning news organization with some people on it who do more traditional mainstream journalism, who kind of go against some of the right wing leanings of the network. But really, it's been an outlet that the Republican Party has been able to use, and that it, they've had a symbiotic relationship. I think there's no doubt about that.
Although the flip side is a lot of people often say NPR is
right.
The
I think that's,
left version
I think,
of
and
Fox.
And I think that's bunk. I just don't think that's the truth. I mean, you know, I mean the fact that, you know, like, for example, Chris Wallace on Fox News is very good. I think he's one of the best question askers of anybody of any of the networks. So I would put him in the category of somebody who's a good journalist and does good work. So I wouldn't put everybody again in that box of saying that they're right leaning. And I think NPR, you know, we do as good a job as we can with trying to have science, facts, and that's what I think is important for people to know.
Let's go to Plymouth, where Kurt is on the line. Hi, Kurt. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, the topic of the conversation initially was, you know, just to talk a little bit about NPR's coverage. And I guess I would say, you know, not just NPR, but a lot of the media outlets, what I hear consistently, you know, and we've heard this term so many times before, is horse race coverage. I, you know, over and over again, you know, I'll hear 5 minutes about who's up, who's down, you know, who's got momentum, who's rising in polls. And, you know, I think that coupled with the fact that these candidates really say very little of substance, you know, leads me, at least as someone who's trying to, you know, make a decision and pick a candidate without much to think about. So I feel like often, you know, the dialogue from the candidates is, you know, 10 dialogues, you know, 10 grade levels below what any, you know, normal person would have in a regular business meeting at work. And, you know, there's just no help in making a decision. And again, a lot of the help certainly doesn't come from the media because of the you know, constant coverage of, you know, who has momentum and who's up and who's down and what, you know, what,
sure.
What was said at what debate that was very little. So,
well,
that's,
Kurt,
you know,
yeah.
That's my observation. That's my observation.
I really appreciate the call. And Domenico, this is a common complaint. So, Kurt, I'm glad you called in, that our coverage is shallow, too focused on the horse race.
Well, if we're shallow, good luck on cable news. I mean, you know, I think that of everybody that's out there, we do among the best work as far as trying to be thinking in, you know, a smart way about how to inform our audience. You know, you do have to cover politics. And part of that is who has momentum. We try not to do as much horse race coverage as others do. And it's important for us to look at policy, which we do. And I would look at some of our coverage online. And we have so many reporters out there talking to people and trying to get their voices on. We're more interested in what others have to say than what we have to say.
Okay, so lots to follow up on after a short break. You can continue to send us your thoughts and comments. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or call 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook. Tweet us. We'll be back in a minute.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Our guest today is Domenico Montanaro, NPR's senior political editor. We're talking about how he and the NPR politics team are approaching presidential primary coverage this year. And we'd love your thoughts. What type of coverage feels useful to you? What would you rather just set aside? Tweet us, comment on Facebook, send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or call 1-800-892-6477. So, Domenico, just before the break, we were talking about a call from Kurt who made a complaint that a lot of people make, that coverage in general, not just NPR, NHPR, but coverage in general is shallow, too focused on the horse race, not enough on the issues. And you started to go there, Domenico, but I'd like to give you the opportunity to go a little further, especially in terms of this complaint that we're not focusing on the issues, you know, healthcare or public safety or taxes.
Well, I think you can find a lot of our issue coverage online and on the air. You know, we have lots of reporters who are devoted just to that. But I would also just caution people in thinking that policy matters all that much. I mean, it's a, you know, and I don't mean to say that what people want to do doesn't matter. But the fact is, a president can only get 2 to 3 major things done usually in his or her first term for the most part. So I'm much more interested in what people will try to do as a president in their first 100 days. Because if you think about what President Obama tried to do, he had to save the economy, try to push through the stimulus. You knew that was the thing that he was going to do. So the first question, instead of the entire debate being about, you know, healthcare, it could have been about, well, what aspects, what ways do you think you want to try to solve the economy? What's the best way to do that? That was part of the conversation. Then he went on to his second priority, which was healthcare. And they had long debates during the primaries about healthcare. That was certainly covered. And then it was immigration and cap and trade. And those were basically it, right? That's all he was able to kind of push through, try to get covered. It's good to know where people stand on the issues, but a lot of times covering in depth a lot of the policy areas that have about as little chance of passage with the what the politics are is also a futile endeavor, to be 100% honest. And they have, you know, a lot of their policy positions on their sites. You can see a lot of that. We certainly break it down, but there's a lot of time and effort spent on some policy positions that frankly will never go anywhere.
Interesting. Well, thank you again for the phone call, Kurt. Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Let's talk about the debates, Domenico, playing a role in that key sorting process that you talked about earlier. Now, it is easy to be critical when you're not involved in the planning and execution of these, but you've been involved in many, many debates, both at NPR and also on television. What have you liked about this most recent round of debates?
Well, I think that the ABC debate was a little more sober than we saw with the CNN debate, where there's sort of a little bit more WWE sort of hype style, I don't know, Monday Night Football maybe kind of aspect to it. And, it should be a little bit more sober than that. And I think that ABC tried to do a pretty good job with it. Now, you could quibble with some of the issue area selection or omissions. You know, there's only so many things you can get to, but there's been a lot of complaints that talking about women's reproductive rights, for example, was left out, especially in a Democratic primary where women are such a key part to the Democratic coalition and were such a key part of the 2018 midterms. And I know I just sort of made the point for why policy doesn't matter as much, but then you have to fill in 3 hours of debates, and you want to know where people stand on these issues. So certainly you're going to try to get to it. The problem is, even in a 2 or 3 hour debate, when you have this many candidates, there's only so deep you can go to scratch the surface to find where the real divisions are. I did think you got a pretty serious understanding of where the fault lines were on healthcare at the top of this last debate. I think
there's a lot on that.
Yeah, and understanding there wasn't much further you could go beyond understanding what that division and fault line was, because you're there to make a choice. So you want to know what the differences and divisions are between the candidates. I think it's false to try to get them to fight with each other so that you have a fireworks TV moment or something.
The WWE that you referenced.
But I do think that it's important to get them to explain why their policy is different than someone else's and what their reasoning is for that, why, and make the case for why their policy position is better than someone else's policy position, or why it would work better, or why it has the potential to pass. because if that's what they're going to push for, we need to have a full understanding of where they stand on that. I think you got a pretty good sense of where they stand on healthcare.
So to those who say, oh, the media is only covering the horse race, what about the issues? Mm-hmm. You could say, hey, the people who ran this debate last time gave them, I don't know, 30 minutes, 40 minutes to discuss healthcare. So go online and look at that. And it was
certainly pretty amply aired there. People might take issue with the fact that the people who are, quote unquote, leading in the polls got most of the speaking time. That's been part of how the Democratic Party has set up who stands where on the debate stage. But it's not just the Democratic Party. This is basically how every debate has been run for all time.
Well, let's hear a little bit from that CNN debate that you put together, Domenico. And I just want to play this clip. It was put together by Politico of the CNN moderators at that Detroit debate, because it does show, you know, it's easy to complain, but it does show just how hard it is to be fair, to get the issues out there when there are so many candidates. Let's hear.
The healthcare industry will be advertising tonight on this program.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Warren, it's your turn.
Oh, can I complete that, please?
Your time is up, 30 seconds.
They will be advertising tonight with that talking point.
These insurance companies do not have a God-given right to make $23 billion in profits and suck it out of our health care system.
Thank you, Senator.
They do not have a God-given right to put forms in place.
Bill, it says that it will kick everyone off of their insurance.
Thank you, Senator. If we could all just stick to the rules of the time, that would be great.
Okay, so as someone who has moderated debates, I feel his pain there. What do you think, Domenico? It's tough.
It is tough. You know, and I think politicians are tough because they are all spin. They have their talking point. You could hear Elizabeth Warren there wanting to kind of browbeat in a populist way corporations rather than having to get deeper into the issue. Now, I'm not going to accuse her of someone who doesn't get into her policies and plans, because she certainly does. But it's an example of how there are these pre-prepped lines that candidates have that they want to deliver because they know this is the biggest audience they have. And the difficulty for a moderator is to get them off of their talking point and to have them answer a question that as they're supposed to be trying to act as a proxy for the audience.
I want to also play a little clip. This shows what you talked about earlier, Domenico, how, you know, it doesn't, it's to some extent, candidates can only do so much. These debates are very long. The last one was 3 hours. And yet there's only so much candidates can do. You talked about Barack Obama basically saying, fix the economy, healthcare. After that, we're done. Here's a little bit from the first MSNBC debate. This is one with two debates with 10 candidates each. And it just shows you how much these news organizations are trying to tackle. And after we hear the clip, I'd like your thoughts on whether news organizations should bother to try to tackle that much. Let's hear.
Tonight, we're going to take on many of the most pressing issues of the moment, including immigration, the situation unfolding at our border, and the treatment of migrant children.
And we're going to talk about the tensions with Iran, climate change, and of course, we'll talk about the economy, those kitchen table issues so many Americans face every day.
And some quick rules of the road before we begin. 20 candidates qualified for this first debate. We'll hear from 10 tonight and 10 more tomorrow. The breakdown for each was selected at random. The candidates will have 60 seconds to answer and 30 seconds.
So you get a sense of, wow, they're trying to do a lot in a limited amount of time with lots and lots of people. Maybe they shouldn't try to do so much. Maybe they should just do a whole debate on one issue or two issues.
Yeah, and they've sort of tried to do some. There was a forum, remember, with CNN. They did like basically 6 hours or 7 hours on climate change because they had you know, 1 hour each with various candidates. And those are more forums because it's not a debate. You're not arguing with somebody else about what your reasoning is for why your plan is better. And you saw there NBC trying to get at immigration, Iran, climate change, and the economy. I mean, these are all very, very big, difficult issues to solve. And I think that's one of the other frustrations, you know, for as egalitarian as Democratic primary voters want to be and say we want all these candidates, a lot of voters are starting to have candidate fatigue, who we've heard from on the campaign trail. A lot of them are saying, when are these people going to drop out? Why are there so many candidates?
Really?
They shouldn't even be in the race anymore. And they're feeling like a lot of it is a lot of white noise, and they're not getting the information they want to get from the candidates who they want to be, who they're really looking at as the potential nominees.
To that point, here's an email from Tina who says, to follow up on Kurt's call, it is true the coverage is not fair. Reporters tend to strongly comment on the top three candidates' remarks and policies when you have other very qualified candidates that are seldom mentioned. The topic will be health care, and the conversation is all about the top three. When you have Amy Klobuchar and others who have great ideas and policies but are not mentioned at all. So Tina asks, how are we to compare or get an idea when the others are barely mentioned? What do you think about Tina's email, Domenico?
Well, the polling certainly does matter when it comes to those debates. I mean, that's how they've been set up by the party, and they're organized based on the polling on their placement on the stage, and essentially gives the moderators an ability to, you know, who to essentially focus on within those debates. And I think that it can be difficult for the people on the wings to be able to get themselves into the main part of the debate. Amy Klobuchar did try to actually do that in this last debate because she was trying to, you know, hug the moderate lane that she didn't do it quite as strongly in the first two debates. You know, part of this is I understand people's frustrations when they have a preferred candidate who doesn't get as much attention, but it's also up to those candidates and their activists and the people who support them to spread their message on the ground, to help their fundraising, to get bigger crowds. And once those things start happening, it's not just polling. It's the kind of energy, activism, and the things that we see on the ground. If there's more of that kind of thing that comes into effect, then you wind up seeing them with more coverage. And these are sort of matches that spark fires to, you know, of people's candidacies. You know, if they're not raising money, if they're not drawing people to their events, then they wind up not doing as well, and meaning that they don't do as well in the polling. The polling is kind of a lagging indicator of the kind of coverage that they're going to get and the kind of person, the kind of support that they have.
Oh, now that's interesting. A lot of listeners probably think polling is a leading indicator. If someone is up in the polls, then the media all jumps on that, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So just explain that a little bit more, Domenico, please. Polling is a lagging indicator.
I mean, I think that the polling helps in what you'll see every other media outlet sort of start to jump on, but it's a lagging indicator of what kind of support that that person has. So the polling winds up, it does wind up leading to more media coverage, but it's a lagging indicator of the underlying support that people have.
Many media organizations after the debates, Domenico, will come out with who won, who lost lists after the debate, and guilty as charged. I enjoy looking at these after a debate just to see what other outlets think. Do you guys do this at NPR? Who won,
no,
who lost?
No, we don't actually. We try to stay away from the kind of gimmicky frames like that. I usually write the questions going into the debate that we might have as sort of a viewer's guide to sort of put a frame on what we might be looking for in an organized way. And then after the debate, I'll usually do takeaways. I try not to have them be about who won, who lost in that kind of explicit way. But identifying things that happened during the debate that stood out, you know, for people who maybe didn't watch it, to give them a sense of who had a good night, who did well, who had, you know, was well positioned, somebody who, you know, had the advantage in one exchange or another. That's the way these debates go, because you want to know who did well within that debate, who scored points on their issue area. So it's kind of all of that wrapped together. But I would say that it's interesting because for as much as people talk about how they don't want to see who won or who lost, the most Googled question the next day is who won the debate. So
yeah, it's tempting. Even if half the time I disagree with their analysis, it's still kind of fun to see what others think.
Right. Agreed. And, you know, look, I think that we have to try to be as serious as possible because these are big, important issues that will affect people's everyday lives. So I think that that is why I think you have to make this balance between, you know, this kind of horse racy sports coverage and something that completely ignores politics. And if you ignore politics, I think you would ignore politics at your peril, because anything that's ever gotten done of consequence, it was done with a good political strategy behind it. You think about the Great Society measures of LBJ. It wasn't just because he put out all of these pie in the sky ideas. He had to do hard work behind the scenes to get Southern Democrats on board to vote for those things. And if you don't understand the politics, you're never going to get the policy through that you want.
I've read some of LBJ's biography, and you're right. He really put the sweat equity in when he tried to get those policies forward. But picking up on something that you said, Domenico, you said, you know, trying to take it as seriously as possible. A lot of late night comedians have also been offering their interpretation in pretty well curated commentaries. Obviously, they're doing it with their own funny spin, but boy, they pull in audio and they do montages and they kind of dress it up. What do you think about the role of the Trevor Noahs and the, you know, Jon Stewarts and the John Olivers in this sort of primary process?
You know, I tend to watch some of them from time to time. You know, certainly I'll enjoy Saturday Night Live. I like John Oliver. I think that he has a – sometimes he actually covers issues that other mainstream news outlets won't cover. So I find that fascinating. You know, they all have their particular frame, of course. You know, they're trying to – you know, in the case of SNL – you know, lampoon some, you know, piece of what happens. You know, the thing about comedy is the idea with it is you take one characteristic of someone or something and you turn it into a caricature. That doesn't mean that that's the actual real true view of what's going on. That's the distorted, purposefully distorted view to make people laugh.
And that's what cartoonists and comedians have always done.
And that's fine, right? I mean, I think that it's good that people laugh. I worry when comedy is the only news source for people. And that has been something that we've seen with younger voters sometimes, where they watch comedy shows to get their news and they don't listen to the actual news. And that can be a problem. But, you know, I think it's fine. People should be able to laugh. We take ourselves very seriously.
Let's play a little bit of Trevor Noah as we talk about the role late night comedians play in how voters view this primary process. Again, here's The Daily Show with host Trevor Noah on the debate recently in Houston.
And while most of the candidates used their opening statement to pitch their version of America, Kamala Harris decided to fast forward straight to her debate with Trump.
First, I have a few words for Donald Trump, who we all know is watching. So, President Trump, you've spent the last 2.5 years full-time trying to sow hate and division among us, and that is why we've gotten nothing done. And now, President Trump, you can go back to watching Fox News.
Oh, Kamala coming with the fire. You hear the crowd? Yeah, happy they were.
Again, that's late night comedian Trevor Noah. So given the importance of late night comedies on especially younger voters who watch that to get their news, as you said, Domenico, without watching the real news, how do you see candidates in that clip, Kamala Harris, how do you see candidates kind of knowing that their statements are going to be used for fodder on late night?
Well, they don't know. They hope so.
Hoping, right, exactly.
I mean, you know, for Harris, that has to be a huge win. She wants to be able to get her name out there. She's trying to step on issues. You know, think about the Brett Kavanaugh essay that was written in the New York Times. She was the first one out there with a fundraising email saying, we need to impeach Brett Kavanaugh. That has gotten her name out there a little bit more. This Trevor Noah clip, us talking about it here, that's exactly why these candidates kind of, sometimes the candidates who have even less standing in the polls will do even more risky things to try to get their name further out there.
Coming up, Domenico, I want to ask you about the role of Twitter in this presidential primary process, both in terms of candidates and also NPR's news coverage. And we'll keep taking your emails, so keep sending them in at exchange@nhpr.org.
Become an NHPR sustainer today for a chance to win a trip to Nova Scotia, Canada. If you're our lucky winner, you and a friend will take a ferry ride from Bar Harbor, Maine to Yarmouth, Nova Scotia for a relaxing five-night stay, where you can cruise the Acadian shores, explore the city's rich maritime history, or eat fresh oysters to your heart's content. You'll be automatically entered to win this incredible trip to Nova Scotia when you support the news you trust at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, municipal cybersecurity and how some cities have been held hostage by hackers. We'll find out more tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, Domenico Montanaro is with us. He's NPR's senior political editor and a correspondent. We're talking about presidential primary coverage in this unprecedented year. And we've been hearing from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Tweet us, comment on Facebook, or call 1-800-892-6477. What news coverage feels valuable to you? What makes you want to tune it all out? Again, our email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Domenico, a couple more emails. Peg in Concord says, I liked CNN's half-hour town hall for each candidate. Much more helpful than the debates. By the way, I want to let listeners know that NHPR and NPR have a lot of resources on our website, too. Interviews with the candidates that your primary, your politics podcast has done, that our folks have done. So, Peg, if you like that, go to nhpr.org for more. Evelyn in Lancaster says, I appreciate your coverage on this present campaign season. However, the tendency with most of the media, if not all, is to focus on the front runners. What you fail to do is give credence to the less visible, perhaps more experienced, yet less grandstanding candidates who, in fact, may be our best hope. For example, Amy Klobuchar. Since this has come up a couple times this hour, Domenico, let's talk a little bit more about it. When you sit down with your politics team, how do you talk about, you know, Amy Klobuchar, Cory Booker, some of these other candidates who, you know, have been dubbed lower tier? These folks have good resumes and presumably some well thought out ideas. So how do you approach them?
Well, we made the effort, as you said, with the NPR Politics podcast to interview all of the candidates. We interviewed 12 of them, which I think is, and we did that for about 45 minutes with each of the candidates, which is probably more than most of the other campaigns, including the other news networks. We interviewed including Amy Klobuchar, Andrew Yang, you know, a lot of people who maybe weren't getting as much attention in the polls, but who we decided, you know, as a public media outlet, we should try to get these folks on tape. And so we did that. And we do look around and say, okay, who haven't we been out with yet? What's their campaign like? What's going on? Where is there a narrative here that we can use for a broader audience to say where they fit into this conversation and what they're pitching that makes sense or matters or doesn't, et cetera. So, you know, we try to get out there and look at these candidates, see who's doing well, but also who might not be and what's happening with their candidacy, and we need to go and cover them. We have limited resources, of course. We have fewer campaign reporters than other places, and I think we do a pretty good job of getting out there with more people than a lot of other places.
Here's another email from Michael, who says, I find that I have to consume news from all sides of the political spectrum to have a more complete picture of the news. Michael asks, are there right-leaning news outlets Domenico uses to round out his views on news stories? Michael, thank you.
You know, I'm not sure that I agree with this idea. I have friends who do this, too, who are like, I watch MSNBC and I watch Fox News. I think that might give me a heart attack, to be totally honest. Like, you know, I do it sometimes and I just try to check in, and I do check in with a lot of the conservative sites to see how they're spinning a topic. But I don't take it as giving any credence to a left-wing or a right-wing site. If I see them, I look for the kernel that could be true, and I try to pull out, kind of sort through the spin that's within each of those articles to find more of the primary source information. I like to know if there's something bubbling up in the conservative, you know, media outlet territory, because that does wind up becoming something that the president talks about. So that can be important because he's the president and he will push some of this material and information, and trying to find what on the left they might be, you know, criticizing the president over. And that tends to also filter into the presidential campaign. So I think it's worthwhile, but doing it with a sharp focus. I think that if you want to know what's actually going on, you probably should watch your most trusted, you know, news, listen and watch your most trusted news outlets.
Here's one from Ben in Hudson. I put NPR and C-SPAN in the same category. They aim to be as objective as possible, but get labeled as part of the left because of their factual nature and the right's opposition to facts, Ben says. He does say, I think both stations could benefit more from covering alternative news and could use programs that are led by citizen journalists and cover topics that mainstream doesn't. Ben, thank you. And as you follow this presidential primary with the team at NPR, the politics team, are you guys sometimes just sitting back and saying, what is no one talking about that we should talk about?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that we talk about is breaking ideas. Mm. We are constantly trying to figure out what's the thing we're missing. Mm. You know, what is the cross current? What's the, you know, if what makes me itchy, and there's this phrase called conventional wisdom or the CW. The CW makes me itchy. I don't like when the narrative goes in one direction and everyone starts to sort of pick up on it and go that way and say, this is the way it is. You know, in fact, I feel that way a little bit right now with the rise of Elizabeth Warren. I've been saying it. I know that it's true. It was something that people weren't talking about, and it's happening. But then you start to think, okay, so what are we missing in that story? And I think that we have to be able to be intellectually flexible enough to say, okay, what's coming then for her? Because the thing that hasn't happened that will happen is once you rise to that kind of top tier, you're going to face a lot more scrutiny. So now you start to think about, okay, what is this person's background? Where, you know, what kinds of things are they probably going to have to answer for? And you know, what might we be missing in that storyline or any of those storylines? The conventional wisdom, that always makes me itchy, and I think it's important to think about places and people that might be surprising. I think sometimes those are the best stories, you know, thinking about somebody who's doing something in a community who doesn't fit into the box particularly well often is the most compelling storyline. And, you know, what people need to understand about polls, for example, just because 60% or 70% or 80% of people think one thing, that means there's 20 or 30 or 40% of people who don't. And I think sometimes that's a more interesting story.
Interesting. And I have this image of you, Domenico, now sitting at your news meetings, like scratching at your arms, going, too much conventional wisdom here. But how do you bust out of that? Is it taking people from your team and just saying, go to Michigan? Go to Texas, go to California, go to Iowa.
Yeah, let's see what people are thinking. Sometimes it'll be, where can we go report? Sometimes it'll be, what can we ask differently in a poll question? Sometimes it's just doing more reporting. I mean, talking to sources, talking to Democratic strategists, talking to Republican strategists and saying, you guys are saying X, Y, Z. Is that real? Is there money behind that? What are you guys actually doing with this? And trying to see if these things that people are saying is the case isn't. You know, one of the other areas where I think some of the conventional wisdom has been challenged is the bleed over between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren supporters. There is some Venn diagram, but there's also some differences between their coalitions. And I think that makes for a much more textured discussion and analysis of the debate. And you get that information because you talk to strategists and sources who actually know some of the polling within the campaigns.
Well, it's interesting. And again, on this theme of how do you get out of the conventional wisdom, how has Twitter affected the way that reporters cover presidential primaries? Does it further the conventional wisdom or does it bust against it?
Sometimes Twitter is completely skews what people think is the conventional wisdom. So Twitter is created, the content is created by a very, very small number of people, and they don't necessarily reflect the broader public, and it doesn't necessarily reflect the broader Democratic electorate. And I think that that's been the thing that's been most surprising. If you were to just read Twitter, you would think that Joe Biden was the Antichrist and there's not a chance he would win because of the vitriol that exists there toward him. And yet he still leads in most of the polls, and not mention the, forget the polls, you go out and talk to people in South Carolina, New Hampshire, Iowa, and they have a very different take on some of these minuscule moments during debates. There's a much longer leash for people who know him and know his brand than Twitter gives him credit for. And, you know, that's something that his campaign continues to stress. And it just so happens to be true. I mean, there are candidates who, you know, Twitter likes who are doing well, and some who they don't. And it's not to say that it's insignificant, because it can be an indicator of a certain segment that has an outsized influence, and whether or not they will do the effort to work for an individual. So I think, but I think that everybody has to take it with a grain of salt and realize what it is and where it fits in, as opposed to going with the themes that are there and thinking that that's representative of everyone.
How do you use Twitter in your own political planning?
I don't know if I use it as much in my political planning as much as I use it for my news gathering. I have various lists of good reporters that I know who I know break news or do good stories on the campaign. And I think that that's a cool way to actually customize how you want to take in your news and take in what's happening. I mean, and to the earlier emailer's point about whether you want to, you know, look at what the right is saying, you can create an entire list of what right-wing news outlets are pushing and promoting. You can see what's trending in those organizations in ways that are less linear than, watching, cable news.
Well, and we only have a couple minutes left, sure. Domenico, and we do need to talk a little bit about whether we're going to see a Republican primary or not, because there have been several developments that we should let listeners know about.
I'm sorry, say it one more time.
Are we going to see a Republican primary? People jumping in.
The Republican primary, there is a Republican primary, kind of. You know, you have Bill Weld, the former governor of Massachusetts. You have Mark Sanford, the former governor of South Carolina, former congressman, and Joe Walsh from Illinois. But these are all flawed people. President Trump has criticized Mark Sanford for hiking the Appalachian Trail. He's probably the most significant potential challenge to the president in this of those three, because of his standing in South Carolina, which is a key early state. At the same time, people also have to realize that the Republican Party is doing everything possible to make sure that these three are not a challenge to President Trump, and limiting the kind of voting and times that that can happen. And you know what? They're allowed to. It's their party, and they can nominate who they want. And President Trump has been helping the RNC fundraise. It's his hand-selected chairwoman who's in there now. It is as much the Trump campaign as it is the Republican National Committee. So I don't think you're going to see them offer much challenge to President Trump in the way of actually having a chance at beating him. At the same time, presidents who have faced even nominal opposition, moderate to nominal opposition in primaries, have not fared so well in their reelection. And whether it's sort of a chicken and egg thing of, you know, does that person harm that individual during the course of a campaign, or is it because there's a latent disaffection for the president within certain parts of the party that don't lead them to want to go turn out for that president? It's not clear, but it can be a problem for a sitting president when they're facing reelection.
And explain to listeners, please, Domenico, how parties determine what happens in a primary election. A general election is another entity, you know, run by the local government or the state. But party primaries are all about party. And if the Republican Party in South Carolina says we don't want a primary, then they don't get a primary.
That's right.
It's not in the Constitution that you have to have a primary.
No, it's not. It's their party and it's the rules, their rules. I think it's potentially problematic in a democracy when you have only really two parties that offer, you know, where you can go. Because if, you know, Bill Weld or someone else wanted to be another party, they could certainly do that. But the resources, the structure all favor the two-party system, and it makes it very difficult to break through, and then becomes very difficult to upend what the status quo is.
Well, and I want to let listeners know that Bill Weld will be on the Exchange. We're doing special forums with all the candidates with a live audience here in Studio D. And Bill Weld will be with us on October 8th. So I just want to let folks know about that. You know, Domenico, before we close out, I wanted to completely switch topics on you and talk about the loss of Cokie Roberts. It's hard to even talk about this. A founding mother of public radio. I was lucky enough to interview Cokie on several occasions. I remember she was obviously sharp with the political observations, but also just a very kind and caring person. You really felt that in her reporting. And I wonder, Domenico, if you have any thoughts on what Cokie meant to you as a journalist personally or what she brought to the profession in general.
Well, you know, she was incisive. She was funny. She was warm. I enjoyed watching her and listening to her commentary. You always knew that she had the real stuff, that it wasn't some, you know, made-up thing where she was just trying to dance around it. She really was imbued with politics. She had a political family that she came from. She's the only person in her immediate family who didn't run for political office, and she sometimes said that that was something of a regret. But she overall, for someone like me who covers politics, she loved politics. And I think that that's a really interesting thing considering the negative views so many people have of politics and what a dirty word they think it is. She really understood that politics was the art of the possible and that you needed to know politics to be able to get things done and affect change. And, you know, she loved even the dirty parts, you know. She loved even the people who, you know, how they campaigned. She loved how all of that actually functioned. And she was no naif about it. She got it. She understood it. And she wanted to tell it clearly and incisively for the audience. And boy, she did that for a very long time. And for all the stories I've heard about how warm and compassionate she was to her friends and mentor to especially women in newsrooms, I think that NPR owes her a humongous debt of gratitude. Nina Totenberg, who is also known as another founding mother of NPR, go listen to her remembrance of Cokie Roberts, and you'll certainly tear up because of all of what she meant to her and how much she cared when she was going through tough times.
Well, I'm sure you'll bring that spirit with you as you cover this presidential primary, for sure. It's a big loss.
Tremendous mentor, and it is a huge loss for all of us.
Domenico, thank you very much for coming to New Hampshire.
Thank
you for
having
me. Hope we see you again.
Yeah.
You can go out on the hustings and talk to New Hampshire voters. They will tell you what they think. They won't be shy about
that.
They do.
So
come back.
I love it.
Thanks for being here.
All right.
Domenico Montanaro, NPR's senior political editor and correspondent. By the way, you can hear his work featured on the air, of course, and on the NPR Politics podcast. Before coming to NPR, Domenico was political editor at PBS NewsHour. He also worked at NBC News, CBS, and ABC. Check out our website today for links to his work and the Politics podcast. Our website, nhpr.org/exchange. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.